So good morning again, dear Thay and dear beloved ones. The name of this Dharma talk is The Sound of the Genuine. The Sound of the Genuine. And you know, offering a Dharma talk is not an individual thing. We co-create the Dharma talk. So we create the Dharma talk collectively, communally, by the way we listen and in the way we speak. So would you be down for like co-creating this together, kind of, sort of, kind of thumbs up, thumbs down, sideways, not so, thumbs up, okay. Feel better about that. So, you know, our teacher says that our life is our message. Our life is our message. And so I'll speak about my personal experience with the sound of the genuine. And then we'll have an opportunity to hear about the sound of the genuine from a person who spent many years looking at what does it mean to be genuine, you know, and you define genuine, like what is authentic, real for you. That's kind of what I mean, like you know it, right? You know it in your heart. You don't need to fact check this. You know it. That's what I mean by genuine. So we'll also, because we're co-creating this together, right, we'll have time in triads, and just before that, you'll have some personal space, some time, some quiet time to reflect within your journal books, and so there are pens here if people need that. So I am a volunteer gardener, and I've been a gardener for many, many years. I actually worked as a farmhand once. And so for me, roots are very important. It's important for me to begin by acknowledging the roots of the Plum Village tradition and practice come from the Vietnamese people and the Vietnamese culture. And so I want to begin by expressing a kind of cultural humility. There's much that I don't know, but I want to share what I do. Because as a gardener, roots are important. Identity is also important to me. Where things come from is important. So I've said earlier that my part of my roots are as an Afro-Cuban person, my mother Cuban, my father Jamaican. So a kind of warmth is just part of my constitution. It's part of my DNA. And speaking about roots and identity, I identify as a woman, as an able-bodied person, as a heterosexual person, as a person of mixed socioeconomic background, meaning that I was born into poverty, but through academic scholarship and the support of many, many people, I was able to kind of make my way out of a poverty situation into a middle-class lifestyle. I also claim the identity of the child of immigrants. And I know that there are other people in this circle who also identify as such. My mother was a maid at the Hotel Manhattan, and my father a tailor in the Bowery. So it took me many years to recognize and to appreciate these identities that I am sharing with you. And of course, there's much, much, much more. From the Buddhist perspective, of course, when we speak of self, of course, we're also speaking of non-self, the non-self elements that constitute this identity. So a little bit about my journey toward what it means to be genuine. So growing up in Brooklyn, I had no intention of being a Dharma teacher, Dharma anything. My intentions were pretty crass. They were to make money and to get out of Brooklyn. And at that time, Brooklyn was not the swanky place it is today. There weren't yoga studios and latte shops. It was a place that people got away from pretty quickly. And so, like a lot of people, I did a lot of running. And I ran from Brooklyn to undergraduate school, and from undergrad to graduate school, and graduate school to law school, and law school to the big and important job. The only problem with the big and important job was that it was killing me. Killing me, I think, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. So being on the run, I was really quite numbed out. And I guess maybe toggling back and forth between being numbed out and being super aggressive. So as a lawyer and a lobbyist, that was what I went to school for, that's what I studied. I tried so hard to fit myself into a mold of whiteness, of white culture, of acceptability, to be acceptable, to fit in. I straightened my hair. I wore very conservative clothing, like black, gray, brown, you know, what would be acceptable. And not knowing that all of this was a manifestation of internalized oppression and many other things. I convinced myself that my status as a lawyer would insulate me from racism and racist people. They would see that I'm different. But I had two turning points that I want to share, kind of wake-up moments, watershed moments that happened. The first was my first meeting with Thich Nhat Hanh. This happened by chance. As I said, I grew up in New York. We lived in Harlem and then moved to Brooklyn. But at the time, my brother was living on 125th Street and Broadway. And just down the street, Thich Nhat Hanh was giving a talk at the Riverside Church. And so my brother, knowing my disposition, he said, "Why don't you go on down and listen to this guy?" You know, it was in the New York Times that he was going to be there. So I went to the talk. When I showed up, I had a bunker mentality, you know, quite stiff, quite hard as nails. Everything that Thay said was the opposite of how I was living my life. I walked out of the talk and I thought, that guy is nuts, right? And so I kept about my own, you know, on my path, make money, you know, whatever, whatever, do my thing. But there was a kernel, a tiny seed that was planted. And so I began to start practicing. I read some of the books. I found a sangha, a community, and I started to practice mindful breathing and with this Sangha, with this community. I started to attend retreats and looked around and thought, well, there'd be people of color, they're going to come, yeah, eventually, but kind of there weren't many people of color. And I kind of was feeling really awkward, really out of place. But I felt that the practices were beneficial to me. And so being kind of being stubborn, I thought, no, I'm going to kind of continue on. In 2004 was another turning point. Thay offered a retreat called the Colors of Compassion in Deer Park Monastery. And there I again started to deepen my practice. And it was an amazing retreat with, you know, just people of all constitutions. And I really could see myself being represented in the people there. And it was like, wow, this is an amazing thing. So I started attending retreats after the Colors of Compassion retreat. And more importantly, I started practicing metta, which is the practice, you know, we shared last night, you know, offering love, kindness, compassion to myself. And what started to happen, just kind of organically, I didn't set out for it, was that my speech began to change. I started to feel softer inside. You know, the internal knots of anxiety and probably depression and many other things started slowly to kind of unloosen. So at work, my work as a lobbyist, as a lawyer, the main job of a lobbyist is to influence people, to persuade them to do something. And part of my way of persuading people prior was, this is the rightness of my position, surely you'll see that. But after practicing metta, after practicing for years, and really being with the Sangha, and studying with our teacher for a long time, what started to happen was that I, instead of focusing on the rightness of my position, I began to get curious about the other person. How do you feel? What is your position on this issue? How does this affect you and your constituents? How does this make a difference in your community? Tell me, I really want to know. People saw that, they connected with that. And my lobbying began to change, and the how I influenced people and my work changed. So I began to see, and not only in myself, but in the quality, the externals, the quality of my relationships, and slowly began to find and discover in myself what I think was really a genuine spirit, a kernel. So that's a little bit about my story. Obviously, there's more. The sound of the genuine. So we live in a time of so-called fake news, right? Institutions like the free press are under assault as fake. We are encouraged instead to believe in alternative facts. And this is confusing, you know? All of this is very confusing. Then we begin to question, who am I? What do I really believe? What's real? What isn't real? What's genuine? What's authentic and what is not authentic? So in the face of this, it's important to recognize what is real within us, what is genuine within us and within our communities in the world. And this is what we've been sharing and practicing all this time with you together. So our teacher, Thay, has said that mindfulness, concentration, and insight, we have an acronym, MCI. Mindfulness, concentration, and insight. This helps us to see clearly. When we see clearly, we know what is happening right now. When we are concentrated, we are focused, right? And when we have insight, we can look deeply at what is and draw wisdom for ourselves. MCI, mindfulness, concentration, insight. This is a path to how we find what is genuine. So I'd like to introduce us, maybe some of us, to another teacher. His name is Howard Thurman. Yeah. There we go. Okay. So by my bedside table, I have a bed. I have a book and a bed. But I have a book that I really love, and it's called Meditations of the Heart. Some people might know it. It's an old book. But it was written by this man by the name of Howard Thurman, Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. So I'd like to share with you a little bit about his life. He was one of the most influential theologians in America in the 20th century. So I'll share a little bit about his life. Then I'll pass out a speech, a tiny excerpt from a commencement speech that he gave years ago. And then we'll read that. And then listen to the sound of Thurman's voice. It's a scratchy recording, it's old. But I think there's a really powerful quality in just hearing this man's voice. And then we'll have some quiet time to reflect with some questions about what's real, what's genuine for you. We'll get into triads and have a conversation and then come back as a large group. So that's the lay of the land. So Howard Thurman, this story of this man. Howard Thurman was born in the year 1900 in segregated Daytona Beach, Florida. He was raised primarily by his mother and his grandmother. His grandmother being, she was an enslaved person for more than 22 years. Though she never spoke about this experience with Thurman. There is a poignant story that Thurman writes about the beginning of his life that I'd like to share. Growing up in the South in segregation, Sir Thurman was a precocious, radically intelligent young man. But because Florida was a segregated state, there were only two schools in the whole of the Florida where he could go to continue his education. So after the seventh grade, he wanted to go on to high school. So the people in the neighborhood got together, they raised enough money to pay for the train ticket for young Thurman and to give Thurman a trunk to pack his belongings. And his mother and grandmother paid for the other half of his passage. So with his money in hand and the trunk, Thurman headed down to the train station. He paid for the ticket for himself. And then realized he didn't have enough money to pay for his trunk. And so he found himself in this terrible dilemma. He sat down on the steps of the railway station and he cried his eyes out. The disgrace, he'd have to go back and he wouldn't be able to continue his schooling. And just then, in between all of his tears, he saw two shoes right in front of him. And his eyes followed the shoes up the pant leg to the face of a black man. And the man stared down at young Thurman. He said, "Boy, why are you crying?" And young Thurman explained his plight. Well, the stranger in the train station, he took young Thurman by the hand, paid for his train ticket, and he sent him off. Howard Thurman went on to become one of the most famous theologians of the 20th century. He founded the first multiracial church in the United States. He wrote more than 20 books, including his tome, Jesus and the Disinherited, which young Martin Luther King Jr. is said to have kept with him every day during the Alabama bus boycotts. You see, Daddy King and Dr. Thurman were buddies, so young Dr. King was greatly influenced by having Howard Thurman around in the house. In the 20s, Thurman studied with the great mystic Rufus Jones, the great Quaker mystic Rufus Jones. And in the 1930s, he took a pilgrimage to India to meet Gandhi to study nonviolent social action. I could go on and on about the life of this great man. Yes, the first dean of the Marsh Chapel, the dean of Rankin Chapel, Howard University, and on with the accolades. He did dedicate his first book to that stranger in the train station. That is the life of Howard Thurman. Howard Thurman is a torch on the path that helps us to see the way to what is genuine. So with that, let's hear, and please, you're invited to keep these. Let's hear what Thurman has to say about what it means to be genuine. So I'll read this through once, and then we'll listen to this in Thurman's own voice, the sound of the genuine. So a word of caution, when many people hear this, they receive it as stinging, but to notice, you know now a little bit about Thurman's life. So place this in the context of knowing a little bit about Thurman's life. The sound of the genuine. There is in every person something that waits and listens for the sound of the genuine in herself. There is in you something that waits and listens for the sound of the genuine in yourself. Nobody like you has ever been born, and no one like you will ever be born again. You are the only one. If you cannot hear it, the sound of the genuine in you, you will never find whatever it is for which you're searching. And if you hear it and then do not follow it, it were better that he had never been born. You are the only you that has ever lived. Your idiom is the only idiom of its kind in all the existences. And if you cannot hear the sound of the genuine in you, you will all of your life spend your days on the ends of strings that somebody else pulls. Howard Thurman.
I was gonna put it. Oops. No, I'm busy. Okay.
Is it?
Yeah, that's it. Wait.
Do you want to put it in the middle?
I was thinking.
Something that we.
Does that? No, that doesn't.
So that is Howard Thurman.
Please.
the bottom of the sheet of paper are three questions for reflection. Describe a time when you heard the sound of the genuine in yourself. How did you recognize it? How did you follow it? Describe a time when you were on the ends of strings that somebody else pulls. If you were to act on your genuine voice, what might you say or do or be differently? So these are mere prompts. If there's another question that is beautiful, waiting for you, go to that question. So we'd like to give you surely not enough time, but let's just take 7 to 10 minutes of quiet, silent time. You can respond to all three, to one, to none, make up your own, but to reflect. At the end of the 7 minutes, we'll then get into triads spaced out throughout the room, in which we'll have an opportunity to share what arose from these questions, the sound of the genuine, or anything you'd like to share about this, the sound of the genuine in yourself. So quiet time. So just taking another couple of minutes. So let's, again, clearly we could keep going. But I want to make sure that we have time for walking and resting. So raise your hand if you really need another minute or so.